Let's head back to civics class a little bit. We may remember learning about the concept of federalism, balancing states' rights versus the authority of the federal government. Our next guest says that American federalism is flawed, doesn't work all that well, in fact. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think federalism is working in America? What do you think about the balance of power between state governments and the federal government? Do things need to be rebalanced? What kind of changes would you like to see? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He focuses on public management and policy. Don also taught political science at UW-Madison back in the day. His latest book is called The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it is so good to be with you and all my friends there in Wisconsin.
Good to have you back. Now, give us our operating definition of federalism, because we say the federal government, that means the national one. Federalism is this whole balancing act, right?
Exactly. I mean, federalism really has to do with how much power the federal government has, how much of that is given to the states, and most importantly, what the balance between them ought to be. It's one of those things that we did learn back in civics class. Most of us have forgotten it since. Most of us think it's pretty boring, except when it turns out that it affects just about everything that we want government to do in figuring out just where power in the system lies.
Now, it doesn't sound sexy these days, but you write that when it was invented, largely by James Madison and his closest colleagues, it was a huge, it was trying to get over deal breakers to make us a country, right?
This was a really big deal, because if it were not for the invention of federalism, there simply would not be a country. At early stages, we managed against all odds to beat the British army and to drive them away. Then the question was, okay, what kind of country should we have? And we tried one system that really gave state governments a lot of power, but without giving a national government very much power. And that, the Articles of Confederation, did not work well at all. And so they had to go back for a kind of version 2.0 of American democracy. The founders met again in Philadelphia, wrote the Constitution. They thought, well, this is it. We've got this made. Except the state said, we're not going to ratify this unless you make clear how much power we're going to have, how much power state governments are going to have. And that created the beginning of the battle about the balance between the federal government and the states, which today we see in everything from COVID-19 to the Affordable Care Act to the question of environmental policy and what the speed limit ought to be.
You write that in many ways, federalism as it was created was doomed to at least some levels of failure. How quickly do we start to run into trouble?
Almost immediately. The idea was, okay, we'll draw a pretty clear line. We'll, as part of the Bill of Rights, create an amendment that says that the federal government has the powers that the federal government has, and all the rest of the powers go to the states. And that seemed a pretty clear line. But then almost immediately, we started having battles, not only, of course, over the question of slavery, which almost tore the country completely apart, but also on everything from education to highways to the question of the Postal Service. It's even the early days of the Postal Service led to the creation of postal roads that with post roads up in Connecticut, up in Rhode Island, there's still a road called the Post Road, which is a road back from those early days to make sure that the post office had a way to travel and to be able to convey the mail from one place to another. But especially on education, there was a debate early on, should the federal government have any role in education? And there doesn't seem to be anything about education itself in the Constitution. But when the federal government started carving up the land and the territories to create new states, there was a big press for trying to get more aid for education. And the federal government carved a piece out of every bit of land, for example, in Ohio. That was the first federal grant that was created. And then we were off to the races. And the question of trying to figure out where to draw that boundary line.
Talking to Don Kettle, political scientist, about his book, The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. Going to skip a bunch of history here, Don, that you flesh out in the book, and get to what you see as one of the core problems in federalism and how we do it. Inequality amongst the states and for the people of the different states. Draw the line for us there.
Yeah, one of the things that's fascinating here is that you hear lots of stories about authors who have an argument that they sit down and they want to write about in a book. This is a case where I wasn't sure where I was going to end up, and I wrote the book in part to try to figure that out. And the deeper that I got into the book, the more clear it became that not only do we have big divisions between the individual states, between, say, Wisconsin and Minnesota and California and New York on the one hand, and then Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas on the other, but those divisions are growing over time. If you want to understand the roots of inequality in America, and not just income inequality, but also in healthcare, environmental policy, in education, and just about anything you can imagine, it turns out that the fundamental roots of that problem really come from the role of the states, the decisions that states make, and the fact that those divisions over time are getting greater. And nowhere do we see a bigger piece of evidence of that than increasingly in healthcare, where that's the grand wedge that's really driving the states apart as much as anything.
You see a remedy for federalism as Madison crafted it, as a compromise in a kind of a popular figure these days, Alexander Hamilton. What would he have to tell us?
Well, Hamilton would, I think, be looking at this and say, you know, I told you, I warned you back there that we were going to get to this point and have this kind of problem. And what Hamilton would have said is that, look, allowing Madison's conception to rule is guaranteed to create a government at the center that's not strong enough to be able to make the decisions that we need to make. He would look at COVID-19 and say, this is precisely what I warned about. You really need to have a national government with the power to define what the problem is and to create a common way of being able to measure it, to develop a policy that can be pursued across the country, and that the consequences of allowing every state to go its own way means that we have some states that are doing pretty well right now, like New York, and other states that are not doing well at all, like North Dakota and South Dakota. And the differences largely have to do with different decisions made by different leaders and different places. And Hamilton, I think, would have looked at this and have been absolutely aghast at this and would have said, I predicted this, but he would have also said, there's a way out of this as well.
Now, you were here in Wisconsin at a time when the state took the lead on what we used to call welfare reform back in the day, and Governor Tommy Thompson and others talked about the state's role as a laboratory of democracy and states being able to pioneer innovative ways to do things. Is there a way to retweak the federal-state balance without losing maybe those opportunities of innovation at the state level?
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really been terrific about federalism in so many ways, because Justice Louis Brandeis argued back in the 1920s that we really need to look at the states as laboratories of democracy. And Wisconsin was one of the grand laboratories in welfare reform, the grand reform that was passed, the one thing on which Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton were able to agree, in fact, was welfare reform. And that came out of experiments that happened in Wisconsin. That was a set of reforms from the Republican side. On the Democratic side, a lot of the efforts that we've been able to make to improve the quality of air, not only in California, but across the country, has come from improvements in air pollution regulations that California's put in place that then have been nationalized as well. And so if you look at this, we've had cases where states have, in fact, served as grand laboratories, have found ways of improving policy. The problem is increasingly we have laboratories where the states are breaking the test tubes and nobody's paying much attention to the results. The idea of a laboratory is that you experiment, find out what works, you do more of what's good and less of what's bad. What's happening increasingly instead is that we're just allowing states to go their own ways. And as states go their own ways, they're not learning these lessons and they're driving the states further apart, so that from air pollution to education to highways to jails to prisons, healthcare, environmental policy, just about anything you could imagine, the quality of government programs, then the differences between the states are getting larger and larger and larger. And those are the things, almost compared to anything else that we could imagine, that is responsible for polarization in the country and driving the results of public policy in different directions.
We're talking to Don Kettle, public management and policy expert, about his new book, The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with what our guest has to say about federalism not working, the balance between state and federal power not really getting it right? Do you think we need something different? How would we get there? If so, do you see in the current example of the COVID-19 pandemic, things working well or poorly when it comes to who's in charge of tackling this thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our conversation about the past, present, and future of federalism in these United States with Professor Don Kettle from the University of Texas, Austin. He's the author of The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. You can join in with your thoughts, reactions, and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don, let's talk about now this current COVID-19 pandemic. Questions about who takes the lead on this national and international crisis. Is it the federal government? Do we leave it to states? How has this all played out through the lens of the work you've done in this book?
You know, one of the things that's fascinating about this is that there could simply not be a better example of the tensions within the system than what we see right now with COVID-19. The fact is, for the basics, that we don't have even a common language for talking about it. We don't have a simple common way of being able to measure the number of cases and the number of deaths across the country. We have different states going in different directions, changing their minds about how to measure this along the way. Even the data that we see on the evening news is largely the product not of the government, but of a special project at Johns Hopkins University, which has put this together. So how can we attack the problem unless we have a common way of talking about it, a common language? What should we do about it? And we don't have a clear sense of what the standards ought to be. We've had battles literally between the states about personal protective equipment and masks, and that's just been an unseemly kind of crisis in the middle of a health crisis that we've had to try to deal with. We've had differences of opinion about what the basic and most useful health steps ought to be with the Centers for Disease Control and the individual states going in different kinds of directions. That the problem is that it'd be one thing if we wanted to allow states to experiment in different ways, for example, of teaching kindergartners. But as long as we're in a position where a disease is just one airplane flight away, one state from another, or one stop at a restroom along an interstate highway away from another. We have a set of circumstances where we have an obligation, I think, to have a national strategy to try to deal with clearly is a national problem. And that is one of the ways in which, sadly, the system that we call federalism has really left us short in the middle of this enormous crisis.
Let's bring on a caller. Jody is with us in Monona. Jody, hi.
I might be doubling some of what he just said, but I think you can see the problem when the federal government, when COVID came out, told all the states to take care of it. The states went and ordered medical supplies and PPE, and then the federal government stepped in and redirected the supplies that states were getting. So they either stay in or stay out, and really we need a national plan.
Jody, thanks for the call. But Don, maybe this was an administration problem, not a fundamental systemic problem. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's one way to suggest it. But at the very core, the central problem really is as central to a constitutional problem as we could imagine, that by allowing the states to go in different directions, by the federal government refusing to stand up and lead, and then suggesting that each state needs to go in its own direction, I mean, how could we possibly imagine that we could have a set of circumstances where we'd have the federal government bidding against state governments for the same pieces of equipment? And governors complained about that at the beginning stages. The fact is, if you look at the spread of the disease in the United States compared to any other system with also a federal system, we rank just about the worst in the world. And the rate of deaths and the spread of the virus in the United States really ranks among, again, the worst in the world. And so for a system that really prides itself on providing power to citizens and giving an opportunity for experimentation, that kind of poor performance is just simply unacceptable. And it's not a place where we needed to go. And at some point, we have to ask ourselves whether or not this is really the product of a basic set of issues and problems that are hardwired into the Constitution. We can change some of this by reforms, by having a clear sense about who it is that needs to do what. but allowing ourselves to continue down this road is going to lead to further problems, not only in dealing with COVID, but also in a whole set of other things we care about, where we're going to be driving a greater wedge of inequality through the country in ways that are only going to undermine the trust that we have and the ability of our government to do what it is we want government to do.
In our last minute and a half or so, Don, what would it take to get from here, where we are now, to there, this, I guess, Hamiltonian-inspired fix to our current federal system?
I think if Hamilton came back, he would say there are some things that the federal government needs to do, the things that clearly have to do with a central driving national policy are things that the federal government needs to have a stronger voice in. Things that have to do with evening out the differences and the things we care most about, especially having to do with inequality in the country, the federal government needs to take a stronger role in. So maybe when it comes to building roads and bridges, the federal government steps back and allows local communities to take more of a role in that. But on the basics, especially having to do with things like healthcare, the environment, and other things that really strike across the country, those are places where I think Hamilton would say the federal government needs to take a stronger role.
And briefly, I mean, this concept of the rights of states to manage more of this stuff, is this sacred text burnt in to America, or was it just a compromise that we should be willing to change?
It was a compromise from the very, very beginning. We have this kind of reverential notion that from the very beginning that somehow we had this exalted sense of things engraved in stone tablets. But in fact, it was a matter of political compromise from the beginning. And that political compromise is something we can revisit. And as I argue in the book, The Divided States of America, is something we think we have to revisit at this point.
Don, thanks again for joining us today.
So good to be with you, Rob.
Don Kettle is the Sid Richardson Professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He previously taught political science at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about his latest book. It's called The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. In a year of COVID-19, social unrest, and widespread unemployment, the Affordable Care Act didn't start off as a major campaign issue in the presidential race, but it's suddenly become one following the death of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. As Shemaine Mills reports, the Republican push to replace Ginsburg has refocused attention on a court case that could scrap the Affordable Care Act.
The U.S. Supreme Court has twice upheld what's commonly referred to as Obamacare, but now the composition of the court has changed. There's one less supporter of the ACA on the high court with Justice Ginsburg gone, and President Trump has nominated Judge Amy Coney Barrett to replace her. Suddenly, Democrats, including former Vice President Joe Biden, have been shifting their focus to the court and the signature health care law they helped pass.
This is about your health care. This is about whether or not the ACA will exist. This is about whether or not pre-existing conditions will be continued to be covered.
The fate of the ACA will be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case scheduled for arguments just 1 week after the election. Trump ran in 2016 on a promise to get rid of the ACA. 4 years later, he's still saying that.
We're going to replace Obamacare with great health care at a lesser price.
Lawyers for the Trump administration have called on the Supreme Court to repeal the entire ACA. They argue that because Congress eliminated the penalty for not having insurance, the law is no longer valid and the whole thing should go. The health care fight is a familiar one, but circumstances are different than they were 4 years ago. Polling shows the law is more popular now. Part of the reason Obamacare initially struggled to gain public support is because people are generally happy with the insurance they have through their jobs. But those who are self-employed either have to go without insurance or buy their own. For the last 2 years, Ron Robleski has purchased a policy through the Affordable Care Act marketplace.
I wanted to have health care. I wanted to have health insurance. I value being healthy. I want to stay walking this earth for as long as I can physically manage.
The 60-year-old Madison mechanical engineer is generally in good health. He's trim and likes to hike, bike, and ski when he's not running his company, Productive Energy Solutions. 2 years ago, he was hospitalized for intestinal bleeding.
I was lucky, and they were able to find the spot where it was bleeding and clamp it off. And it was, a successful and successful intervention.
Robleski says if he hadn't had insurance, he probably would have delayed going to the doctor.
So it's just absolutely mind-boggling to me that in the midst of all that, people are still talking about gutting the ACA and kicking more people off of their health insurance.
The global pandemic has also placed healthcare in a different light this year. Hundreds of thousands have died in the U.S. and millions have lost their jobs. Karen Politz is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
It just provides a new lens for thinking about all these things. So, you know, insurance covering preventive services, including vaccines, very popular when you think about insurance covering a coronavirus vaccine. You know, that just sort of makes it, I think, real for people in a different way.
Beyond that, there are other elements of the ACA that affect nearly everyone. For example, it lets children stay on their parents' insurance until they turn 26. And it also got rid of a donut hole in Medicare prescription drug coverage. And it eliminated annual and lifetime limits on health coverage.
And if that were all overturned, people would notice.
Trump and Biden are still talking about other topics, from one another's temperament to police to the economy. But the pandemic, along with the death of Justice Ginsburg, has once again put a focus on the Affordable Care Act, a law that has divided the country for more than a decade. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate checks in with the Wisconsin Hospital Association to find out how hospitals around the state are coping with Wisconsin's surge in COVID-19 positive cases and hospitalizations. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show.